Welcome to Possibility Project. This is the 30th episode, How Do We Train the Next Generation of Changemakers? And Possibility Project is a growing community of disruptive changemakers reclaiming our power through meaningful sparks, connections, and actions. And I'm so happy that you're here. If you have missed any of the past episodes, you can check them all out on the YouTube channel. You can also go to possibilityproject.org, and you can take a look at any of those that you might have missed or that you want to watch again and again and again. They've been absolutely amazing. Our speakers are fantastic. So I am Heather Hiscox. Started Possibility Project in March of 2020 is when the conversations first started, and the first episode was May of 2020. And it was just focused on how do we have these larger conversations at scale. So Devin and I used to always joke that these were the conversations we had in the dark corners of cafes with trusted friends and colleagues. And we really wanted to have them with a larger community of folks that were really like-minded and wanted to challenge status quo and really think about some of these issues. So I'm the CEO and founder of a company called Pause for Change. You can learn more at pauseforchange.com. I work with social impact organizations to essentially help them do a better job addressing challenges with new problem-solving skills. So you can learn more. And the goals of Pause Project are to bring us together, again, create a community of folks that want to have these conversations, stimulate this new thinking and a thirst for deeper change. We want to collaborate, and we want you to network and make different connections, and then really start with ourselves and thinking about what we all need to do. What's the personal internal work that we need to really help spread this larger trend? So if you can help this work in any way, it's absolutely fantastic. If you can support, if you go to opencollective.com/possibilityproject, those gifts, monthly gifts, one-time gifts, really help this work continue and keep spreading. And it's all of our speakers are all volunteer. All the work that I do is volunteer, so there's more of that. So thank you. So I want to mention that land acknowledgement before I go to going through the full list of what we're going to do together today. So I come from the land that was kept and held sacred by the Thonohorum and the Pascuayaki people. I'm in Tucson, Arizona. And I honor these ancestral keepers of the land where I am now living, and I honor their descendants continuing to breathe sacred life into our earth. And I just want to acknowledge that territory acknowledgments are just one small way that we can disrupt and dismantle colonial structures. And if you want to learn more about the land that you occupy, there's a link that Angela is going to put in there. It's for Native Land Digital. And so you can check that out. And I also want to acknowledge that a lot of our guests do have a U.S.-based perspective. I think Odesma will help share a little bit about how her perspective is a bit different. And I just want to describe myself visually. I have fair skin. I have red hair, freckles, blue eyes. I'm in a colorful room with lots of art. And I will share a detailed transcript via Otter with that thank you email 48 hours. And that will have all the different resources. And LinkedIn group is a really fantastic way to get involved. So there's a link that you can click and you can join the LinkedIn group for Possibility Project. We currently have 755 disruptors in that group, and we would love to have you part of it to network and to meet others. And we're going to get to the agenda now. So today we're going to next hear some intros from our guests. We're going to hear their lightning talks about what they see as dysfunctional related to our topic today. They're then going to discuss what's emerging that gives them hope. And then we'll do Q&A and send you to breakout rooms so you can actually get to meet, which you'll also do in a moment. And then we'll share some takeaways and I'll talk about our next episode. So that is the agenda. And so the why for today was really prompted by some of my experiences guest lecturing in different universities across the country and just co-designing experiences with different professors and folks in academia and just running into some of these larger questions of how do we co-design and teach that to students and to professionals in some of these constraints of semester settings and all of that. And then how could some of these institutions that have had challenges with equity and access really be rooted in shared power? How do we make it less theoretical and real change? And then some of these organizations have trouble being innovative and engaging with stakeholders. So how to teach students and professionals to do that? So those are the big questions guiding us today. So Now, what we've all been waiting for, we want to meet our main speakers. So I'll stop sharing so we see each other. Our speakers are absolutely just fantastic, and as I shared, all volunteer, so I appreciate you all so much. So first, I'm going to introduce Odesma Dalrymple. She's Associate Professor and Engineering Exchange for Social Justice at the University of San Diego, and we do intros a little bit different. I'll be pasting all of the speakers' impressive bios in the chat, and you saw them in the reminder email as well. But we ask that each of our speakers tell us a little story about themselves to get us going and make us all feel connected. And so, Odesma, will you kick us off? Share a little something about you?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me here, Heather. And thank you to all of us who are gathered here and sharing in this space and in this dialogue. I'm very honored to be here. I just came back from a long overdue visit to my home country of Trinidad and Tobago. And it was really refreshing and sort of really filling me up and certainly me reconnect to just that genesis that is really a big part of who I am today. And so I think one of the things I wanted to share, I know we may be exploring a theme of sort of what were we like as students growing up. And I was really privileged to go to a high school that was for girls, all girls, particularly Black girls, not that it's specific, but it just happened to particularly attract Black girls. And it was a real legacy for me to go there. My mother went there, her sisters went there. So, I mean, it comes with this rich tradition of many prominent women in my country having also students from this particular institution. And I often really identify with my, I guess, my womanhood as being a huge part of my identity and what shapes my perspective. And a lot of that really emerged from having gone to this particular high school where being a woman was really seen as a position of strength. And because we were, I guess we had that opportunity, we weren't sharing the space with male peers. We didn't have that same sort of complexity about, oh, do I have to, you know, appear less smart than I am? I mean, we allowed that space to just be and to sort of observe each other in all the greatness that was possible for women in our society. And I think that was just very powerful for me and has continued to really shape my perspective, life. So I guess I kind of wanted to just touch on that piece and just how powerful it was for me to have that particular experience as a emerging learner in my society.
Oh, I love that. I love how you talk about your genesis. That's from where you grew and to have that nurturing support in such an amazing environment. Wow. Thank you for sharing. So our next guest that I'll introduce is Nate Wong. So Nate Wong is with Georgetown University, and Nate's going to talk about his expansive thinking as a child in education. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be part of this conversation. And I'd love to just invite you all to also put on your videos. It kind of creates a little bit of intimacy if you're able. But to Heather's point and what Odesma was talking about, my genesis when we were kind of preparing was thinking about what was Nate like in the classroom. And if I think about my elementary self, I was pretty obsessed with oceans and the sea. And so a lot of my fascinations really showed up in that way. And so one of the projects that I was asked by my teacher to do was to create a science fair project around, I think it was coral reefs. And instead, I took that as a way to turn an adjacent classroom into an ocean museum. I had music, I had the cellophane paper on the ceiling to mimic what it would be like under the sea. So I think, you know, even for me at a young age, the learning experience I felt needed to be more immersive and fun. And as I think about that, I think it has actually translated into a lot of how I approach problem solving. I was telling the group earlier that I feel like a slight imposter coming into the coming into this space, because I don't have a traditional academic background. I've spent time in all of the different sectors, and it really is this sense of being immersed in the work so that you can actually teach and impart some of that wisdom to others, but also to learn. So I'm so excited to be here.
You mate. I also wish I could see a picture of you. If you do have that at some point, you want to send that, include that in the follow-up email.
Yes, very nerdy Nate.
I think that's fabulous. Oh my gosh. I love that story of imagining beyond it. And like we talked about in our speaker chat, we all come to this work from so many different perspectives. So I love it. All perspectives are welcome, you know, traditional, non-traditional. And what is traditional, right? And what are we trying to disrupt anyway? So I love it. Okay, so our last but not least guest today is Anne Verhey. So Anne is Strategic Director of the Center for Socially Engaged Design, CSED, and a lecturer in the Problem Solving Initiative at Michigan Law. So Anne, share a little story about yourself.
Thank you. I'll just echo, like, it's an honor to be here and see either friendly faces or friendly pictures of yourself. As Nate was the one who posed this, like, what if we used like who we were as a student as the way we introduce ourselves? So I think a quick way to give you a glimpse into who I am and what has shaped me in my career is that I am, in fact, a product of a math professor, and I am the youngest of four girls. And I've spent my academic life growing up essentially following all of my siblings, and it was either I was either somebody's younger sister or Roger's daughter. And so I think for me, education was often a moment, was like trying to figure out, okay, I can be defined by that, or I can try to figure out who am I as Anne, as a student, as a person that's separate from and yet connected to my family. The little kind of other story I would say that I think will tie into some of the ways I see my work now is that both my father and one of my sisters knew from a very young age what they wanted to do. They wanted to dig deep into a specific academic topic. So for my dad, it was math. My sister is a cell biologist. So I just thought that that's what I should do. And so I was deeply curious about ways in which people's spiritual lives or religious beliefs could serve to build anchors and points of connections across difference. So I thought I should go get a PhD because that's what you do. And I took this little detour into a Master's of Divinity because I was advised by one of my female faculty members that as a woman, I needed some credentials behind my name. And so along that detour, I learned actually that I'm not actually singularly interested in one topic, but I'm actually really deeply curious about lots of topics. And that what I find a lot of joy in my work, both with students and faculty, is to help others discover those deep connections across disciplinary boundaries. And I feel really, despite the dysfunctions that we can talk about within higher education, I feel really lucky that at Michigan I've been given space to support faculty and students to build those connections across those disciplinary boundaries, and look forward to more opportunities to do that in my career.
I love that. And I love how you've talked about defining yourself in relation to, right, your family, but also trying to find that independence and your journey of being shaped by others and really claiming who you are and learning through your journey. I think that's really inspiring. Fantastic. So now I am going to send all of you to a quick breakout room. Do not panic. It's very quick. It's just to meet another person. You'll just have a couple minutes. It's just to introduce yourself, you know, where you're from, and the prompt, if you want to answer it, what's something that made you smile today? If you have something to share that, we're keeping it light, just a couple minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll get into the heart of it, of what dysfunction mantle in this area. So I'm going to send you right now, and you'll get a little 30-second warning, and then we'll be right back. Here we go. Welcome back, everyone. Friends are rejoining. Hey, Trey. Good to see you. Thanks again for your welcome back. Wait for everyone else to land back with us. Hey, Stephen. Jason, it's been a while. Good to see you. All right. Well, I hope you had a great little short conversation with a wonderful person that's here today. So now we're going to go into the core of this conversation. And if you're new to Possibility Project, we always ask only two questions every single episode, all 30 of them. The first is, what dysfunctions do you want to disappear related to the topic? And this topic is about how to train the next generation of change makers. And then the second question, which we'll go to next, is, what's emerging that gives you hope? What action, what resources, what inspiration can we all take with us today? same two questions for every different topic. So we're going to start with Odesma. And Odesma, I would love for you to talk about what dysfunctions you want to see disappear around this topic of training the next generation.
Awesome. So I think I have three points that I just wanted to sort of touch on. So first of all, I want to say that I speak specifically from a context of engineering. That is the discipline which I work in and operate. And I do want to acknowledge that, you know, what happens in engineering and the challenges that impact change making and the way we are facilitating the learning of future change makers in engineering will be different in different disciplines. But specifically to engineering, I feel one of the hindrances is, I think, in relation to maybe I say other disciplines, engineering has not really had as much of that critical exploration of ourselves as a profession, right? Like really having that critical dialogue in terms of the origin of engineering and how it came to be and the dominant sort of cultures that really shape a lot of what we know now as engineering culture. And particularly really examining the ways in which there are great things that have come from that, sure, but there are also really not so good things that have come from that, particularly in terms of who's been excluded from the conversation, right? Whose influences have been excluded from the conversations. And in many ways, that has really shaped the fact that when we think about engineering, we don't often think of women sometimes. You know, women are very underrepresented in this field. People from different ethnic minorities, at least in the context of the United States, are not as well represented either. And so I think that's a big part of the challenge that I would love to see continue to go away, that one, we need to have that critical dialogue about engineering, the profession, and how it's evolved and where it's going and why this trajectory is the way it is and in the ways in which that has, in fact, impeded a lot of things as much as it has brought about certain benefits. The second point, too, I would add to that is this siloing, right, that we have really siloed a lot of the engage. And so you can think about the different professions. You know, there's mechanical and electrical and industrial, and they're siloing just in terms of different types of engineering, which is not so great. And I know there are many efforts now around interdisciplinary, but still at the core of it, there you still find, at least in the academic environment, there's still a lot of challenges when we start to think about how do we intersect different disciplinary knowledge. And part of that is because we feel like we have to teach these things. Oh, if they don't learn this, oh my gosh, they're not going to be effective. And we don't know what to let go of. And so when it comes to interdisciplinary, there is this struggle because I feel like if I have to engage students in this new knowledge, then what is it going to mean for this traditional knowledge that everybody who has come through a particular pathway has known? And so we don't want to let go of that. And that has also been a huge hindrance. So particularly when I think of a lot of change making, which is bringing in a lot of these dialogues about things about racism or, you name the ism, right? We're beginning to have that critical conversation about that. And all of a sudden, you know, some of my colleagues are wide-eyed open and ready to like, what are you doing in an engineering class? Bringing in such topics. And for them, it's like, I mean, maybe inherently they're not against it, but they're like, if you're doing that, it means you're not doing this other stuff that we traditionally were doing. And therefore, our students are not going to be prepared enough for the world that, you know, I guess at least some of my colleagues see as what is important for engineers. And then I think with that also just comes this value of different forms of knowledge, and that knowledge comes in many different forms. And I think maybe all these points are really interconnected, because if we're not having these critical conversations about how engineering is being defined by a very specific dominant culture, we don't realize that we are missing so much more that can influence our profession in such meaningful and powerful ways. And when we think about the greater, wider world that is not necessarily reflective of who's part of that dominant culture, we are not really able to tackle those problems and needs because we don't have the representation who really understand that lived, true experience. And so I think it's the not having the critical conversation, the siloing of our disciplines, and then not having that openness to just there being multiple different ways, plurality in the ways that knowledge exists and the power that can bring for the way we explore and engage in problem solving. And I'll end there. If I hope I didn't go over.
No, it's fabulous. And there's so many through lines that I think extend beyond engineering, right? I love all the points around, you know, what really resonated was if people are feeling uncomfortable, you kind of express discomfort that people might feel like, but if we miss this, what happens? And if we talk about this, what happens? And, you know, if we engage different people, what happens? And it's cracking open, you know, who has held the power, who has defined the narrative, who has set the bar. And those expectations and outcomes and what it means, right? And I love your thoughts around interrogating all of that because it is absolutely all right. Well, Nate, I want to hear from you. What would you like to ditch? What dysfunctions do we need to get rid of?
So I come at a lot of this work, being an engineer by training, but then also looking at it much more holistically around incentives in the system. And so they dovetail on what Odesma is talking about, but I think if I could zoom out even beyond just higher education, the input and output side of that equation are flawed. So we can talk about the system itself within, but I think even what are the prerequisites that define people coming into higher ed and questioning that altogether? Is higher ed actually the prerequisite for certain jobs? I think we're now seeing a lot of different, trade schools and other avenues where you might not need the same type of training, and it would be tailor fit to different individuals, different circumstances. Especially in the U.S. context, it's expensive, and it's important to recognize that and understand the value that individuals get out of that. And access, and who is able to access a certain level of education and what monikers are imbued because of that, and how that affects a person's trajectory. I think it also, like on the output side, on the employer aspect, that is also interesting. And I think Odesma was talking about, you know, how do we prepare students for, you know, what's next? And the what's next, I think we have to question and think about and interrogate. Like, do companies or, other pathways out off-ramps from higher ed, do they even know what the skills are that they need? And are they overvaluing certain skills versus the other? And so that's one side. I think when we look inside the container of higher ed or education, having spent a lot of time in private sector, I think the power dynamics actually mimic a corporation versus a container for co-learning. And I think this is the interesting part about the power aspect, where there's a real emphasis on imparting knowledge versus instilling a love of learning and curiosity. And I think that that's actually really important to hit on, because when you're imparting knowledge, it oftentimes is defined by someone, usually in a higher power position. It usually incentivizes linear or binary thinking, that there's only certain career paths or there's success markers. And to me, that oftentimes focuses on the wrong extrinsic motivations rather than really looking at the intrinsic aspects, which, you know, are some of the things that Odesma was talking about. Understanding your own lens. Where does identity come in? Where do your lived experience? How do you recognize your own bias? How are you looking at the world through a multidisciplinary, holding multiple identities in mind? And then lastly, we work and touch on the innovation side. And so I think it's important to look at a very meta, like how you're teaching innovation, but also how you're disrupting yourself. And that there's not really, like, the structures have to be in place for that type of disruption. You've all heard of like Skunk Works or these side apparatus that are given the autonomy to innovate and then are transplanted back into the organization and received well. I think in a lot of higher ed, there's a lot of talk about disruption and innovation, but not really much acceptance to change the very systems themselves. And so how do we put ourselves in a posture where we're able to disrupt and be the experimental hub to hold all the different forms of learning and knowledge? And how do we parlay that from free to practice and reconstruct those incentives? So some would call this like eating your own dog food. And I would say higher ed does not do that very well.
Yeah, I love your framing around what leads up to the higher education experience, the access, and then what that experience is like when you're there, and how can that be disrupted and interrogated, and then what are we working towards? Is it, you know, a high-paying job that will increase the ranking of the university? Is it a status-related job? What does it mean to change the world if that's the goal? And those are the benefits that students are seeking, being rewarded. It's really big, important questions to think about all those through lines. And I also want to note that when I was curating this panel, I wasn't looking for all engineers. It was just funny when we had our speaker chat. I was like, well, I know that Desmond's in engineering, but I didn't know that Anne and Nate had engineering backgrounds. So voila, we have an engineering connected panel totally by accident, but it's also lovely because, you know, it's all about imagining and creating. So glad we have all those connection points. So thank you, Nate. Okay, Anne, I would love to hear from you. What dysfunctions do you want to disappear?
Oh, man. So first of all, I'm not an engineer. I just happen to work in a college of engineering. So I actually find that I'm often saying that in meetings, like, I'm not an engineer. So I've been in a college of engineering for 3.5 years of a 25-year career at Michigan. And I've had many roles at Michigan. So Odesma said, like, she's coming at this from an engineering lens. And in some ways, I've swooped into a college of engineering from a public health framework and have been enjoying actually the similarities as much as the differences. Engineers are often like, well, we're not like those other. I'm like, oh no, you are. So I think maybe the one thing I would say, I have a couple just kind of points, which this is the challenge of going last, but almost 2 years ago, I took this workshop that Creative Reaction Lab was putting on called How Design Thinking Supports White Supremacy. And it really gave me the gift of naming something that was always lurking beneath the surface. And I didn't quite have a name for it. And of course, that name is white supremacy culture. And in the fire hose of the learning moments that they were giving us that day, they were asking us to do some reflection on looking at white supremacy culture characteristics and you know, which ones do we see where we work? As I was kind of diligently like going through the list, I'm like, all of them are showing up in the academy and what we value. So that the dysfunction runs deep and is at the very foundation of the structure itself. So yes, I want to dismantle dysfunctions in the academy, but recognizing how deep and connected it is. And maybe one example of a cultural characteristics that we had actually talked about as a group in the kind of the before we had this our kind of pre-meeting was the idea of right to comfort. And what we're trying to teach in the engineering space is asking students to think about engineering as both a social and a technical discipline, which Odesma's talked about how hard it is to start to bring that social in, but thinking about the broader context in which what has been defined as, quote, an engineering challenge exists. So questioning the history, the environment, the social, the political context. And when we look at that broader context of a specific challenge, we often are confronted by systemic racism and injustice, of course. And our tendency and our learning journey with students is to quickly, like all of us, kind of want to move past that feeling of being uncomfortable. And I think our challenge is to create spaces for us to stay uncomfortable for a while, because I think our ability to learn to sit in discomfort is in fact the thing that helps us grow and learn together. And one question I often suggest to students, particularly engineers, because they become engineers to, quote, solve problems, is to ask themselves the question, am I actually the right person to be addressing this challenge? Recognizing that we come with a set of power, privilege, and identities that may or may not be appropriate in a given challenge. And I also know the other thing that's kind of came to mind as I thought about this, and Odesma mentioned this, is the silos. And I think it's really interesting, Odesma, that you mentioned the silos across disciplinary disciplines within engineering, right? So I didn't realize that engineers thought mechanical engineers are so different than chemical engineers, so different than industrial operations engineers as I got here. And so when people were saying we're really interdisciplinary, what they meant was like a bunch of different engineers in the room. And where I was coming from was there's, when I talk about interdisciplinary work, I'm talking about like where we got some social workers in here, we got some policy people in here, we have an engineer in here, we have an artist in here. Like that's what it means to me to be interdisciplinary. So it's been a really interesting learning experience for me. But that when students come to Michigan or places like Michigan, they're coming because they're like, ooh, I can learn lots of things about a lot of different topics and then I can go deep. But that depth actually creates these structures by which we've then siloed from each other, which oftentimes literally is brick walls between us. For me, what I would say is both dysfunctional, but also could move us into conversations about some like hope is how might we in our work build those connections across disciplines and also across multiple forms of what does expertise looks like. So we have a coin of our realm around expertise here, but helping students and faculty start to recognize expertise is not actually always academic. And that lots of expertise as much as it is into that scientific knowledge. So I think it's for me, like the uncovering and having those conversations and seeing people more and more open to those conversations, that is both a sign of our past dysfunction, but also a glimmer of an openness that I haven't seen in my career.
I'm trying to unmute myself. That's awesome. Yeah, I think that's fascinating that you bring up the point of language too, like your definition of interdisciplinary. And just within the college, the definition of disciplinary, I think that's really interesting to get to the roots of the language, and that gets to the core of those narratives and who's having those conversations. I think that's fascinating. And I love that you brought up Creative Reaction Lab, and I put it in the link. They have amazing classes you can take that will just open your mind to new ways of thinking and interrogating how you show up to the work. And here you can engage in the work, whose perspectives are missing, and again, dismantle some power structures. Okay, thank you all for that. So we don't just want to talk about the bad and how we got there, but we want to talk about what's possible. So I would love for any of our speakers to jump in and, you know, Anne started to allude to some of it's dysfunctional, but there's some change, there's some emergence happening. So what would any of you say of our speakers about that second question? What's emerging, do you hope? What are you really looking toward and inspired by? Whoever wants to jump in first, go on.
I'm so sorry, Hev. I got disconnected and just got reconnected. Can you just repeat the prompt?
Yes. No problem. We're just answering that second question of what is emerging that gives you hope. What are you seeing that you're excited about or that are glimmers that things are changing? So any of you speakers, Anne, Nate, Odesma, you can jump in and start answering.
Well, I think I definitely would like to really connect to Anne's point about redefining this notion that engineering is really social. I mean, we often speak about that here. It's a socio-technical versus the very technocentric way in which it's been, you know, more socialized for more people. Like people think of engineering, they really think about the, you know, very technical field. But in actuality, it really should be perceived as a socio-technical field. And there are documents, I should say academic documents, that have indicated this conversation has started a long time ago, but yet it's really been slow in the uptake. I mean, it's, you know, I recently look back from, you know, things since the 70s where you were beginning to have these, not, you know, 70s not long, but, you know, it's in considering it's a while, it's like almost 50 years ago. And, you know, this conversation about engineering really being socio-technical was part of the discourse, but yet we feel like we're still right back there in the beginning where it still seemed new and emerging to have that kind of discussion. But it is really awesome when you hear in different institutions that is resonating. And I imagine And there is great resistance to some of that too at Michigan, but we're moving forward, right? Like we're saying, yeah, I know you're not down with this yet, but we got to move forward. This is something that is important for us to truly recognize and embrace. And so I take a lot of, it excites me to hear more and more conversation around this embracing of the socio-technical nature of engineering. And I think that, you know, to, again, to Anne's point, really allows us to open ourselves to interdisciplinary beyond just the mixing within engineering, but really bringing in all those perspectives. And I did want to touch on one last point before I turn over. I know in one of the earlier slides, Heather, you had sort of like, how do we, and I think it was kind of one of the last points, but how do we help our students kind of move from the theoretical to the real application? But I actually will caution, I think the challenge with this new embracing of this concept of the technical is that traditionally engineers have not really been exposed to the tools in the way our colleagues in the social sciences have been to really deal with these social systems, right? I mean, if you are in sociology, psychology, I mean, you have learned these critical lenses in which to help to really critique and understand these complexities of social systems. And that's not been part of the discourse and the training for engineers. So often they don't have those tools. And I think the fear for me is that we try to simplify. We're very superficial in the way we want to treat that. So we say, oh yeah, maybe I get it. But then we want to quickly jump over that hurdle and get back to where our comfort zone is, which is dealing with the technical piece. And so, I almost want to caution that we really do need to help our students gain some of that theoretical framing to really begin to digest and critique and then begin to take action on how we understand the complexities of social systems before we can even get to the point of how do we get to the application. Because I think that is what engineers are already great at. We like to hands-on. We want to get in there. We want to build. We want to find a solution. We want to quickly get to that point, but without doing the due diligence in really understanding the system that exists and all these complexities, the political, the social, all the context that has made this problem long lasting and ongoing. And I do feel like we do need to pull back in some of those theoretical framings to help students, particularly in the technocentric disciplines, at least in the way others may perceive it, understand how to begin to make sense of social components.
Oh, such a good point. Yeah, it's so true that systems thinking, understanding all those interactions and those systems that were designed, right? Those systems were designed. Many are sobered in white supremacist culture and oppression and revealing and having critical conversations about that and applicability to the work. I love that. So thank you. Nader, Anne, jump in. What's giving you hope?
Well, actually, one of the things that gives me a lot of hope is the students themselves, right? Like, we teach a section on power, privilege, and identity, and we use a case study of like a company building an app. And oftentimes we talk about the example of the case study and then, you know, teach some concepts around power, privilege, identity, and then we go back to that case study and this, like, standard education methodologies, but you know, go back to the case study and now do you see this differently? And what we've seen, particularly in the last few years, is you present this case study and the students are already picking it apart for all of the things that we're about to, like, you think we're going to, you know, teach them something, which I love. And the depth that they understand intersectionality, plurality, perspective taking, the way power shows up, the way, like, it's one of the case study we use is around Jeff Bezos, right? Like, so like how technology is like the foreseen solution to a problem that has yet to be defined, but I'm sure it's going to be an app. And in the student work we do, it's always the app. Like, apps are fine. They're like the knee jerk solution to the world's problem. So I think for me, it's like the students themselves are coming in with a depth of understanding and an openness that actually we don't necessarily always see amongst the faculty. So finding ways that we can create anchors and hooks for students to kind of dig deep to Odesma's point and like recognize the expertise outside of the engineering discipline that the social sciences do bring, and valuing that expertise as expert as our technical expertise, right? So I think oftentimes the engineer is the expert and they're bringing in this other expertise as, and it's like an othering of that expertise. And I think with, at least within our College of Engineering, we have a set of leaders who, are willing to have hard conversations about the value of expertise and like centering expertise that's not the technical. I feel like we're in this like really interesting moment at Michigan that does give me a lot of hope, even if it feels like we're constantly swimming upstream. But we're swimming upstream because the foundation, the system is built to work against us. So, yeah.
I might be a little controversial in the sense that I think that there's a lot of siloing, even in some of how we're framing this conversation, right? Like engineering as a discipline. And sure, I completely agree that there's fundamental aspects to teach within that discipline. But I think it becomes actually really challenging because there's something powerful to Anne's point about students coming in across multiple disciplines through their very lens that they're studying. And what that does when you bring them together and the multiplicity of those lenses and how they can learn from each other. And so I actually think the very nature of education, where I'm hopeful, is that we're teaching a different power sharing paradigm. So instead of the academic or the teacher being the source of imparting knowledge, I think that there's starting to be a little bit more of a sense of, how can students actually learn from each other? How can we as academics learn from our students, right? And in a lot of ways, they're way more advanced in certain topics than I would ever be. I have no clue how to use TikTok, any of that stuff. but I think it's actually really important. And so I've seen a lot of how that shows up in feedback. Like, how do you actually solicit feedback in the midst of a course where students feel like they have agency over their learning? And that's really hard from a traditional academic standpoint to completely change, go off syllabus or, you know, to go out of your plan. But I think that is actually really interesting as students start to take control and ownership of their own learning instead of just sitting passively and consuming information. They have their iPhones for that. Like, there's a very different paradigm that with technology we're starting to see. Two, I think consciousness is really important. I think that's a lot of what we're talking about to me is, how do you teach consciousness for people to show up as better humans, to have a heightened sense of the context that they're in, to look at history, to the future, to draw nuances and context into their own context. And so that I think I'm really fascinated by. I'll share in the chat, I piloted a program in the fall called Building a Social Impact Consciousness, and it's all about how do you think through power identity, but also looking at all the incentive structures that underpin a system. So you could design something from an engineering standpoint, but if there's commercial value that is incentivizing certain features or a certain algorithm, that may lead you in a different path. You can't say that you are hands off from that. Like there is a role that you played in that, and whether you're directly complicit or not, I think those are interesting conversations. Yesterday we convened the Facebook whistleblower, and she spoke a lot about kind of, you know, what it was to be an engineer put into a context of Facebook, and how was she incentivized? And where were the checkpoints where she could raise flags, and where was that like squashed inside the organization because of the commercial aspects of of that. And so I think it's really important. And I see a lot of the same parallels in engineering and business and the way business is taught. And I'm sure public health, like all of these disciplines have the same thematics. And I want to be careful in some ways that we create a bigger container versus, I think, trying to connect the dots in a piecemeal way.
And yes, Jill, I see your question. The recording will be sent in 48 hours after the episode. So you'll get the recording, all the key takeaways and resources, and you'll get the transcript as well. Such good points. And I'll start with the first question, but any of you that are here that have questions, please put them in the chat and I'll put them forth and our speakers can join. And just to call out in the chat, there are different resources being shared. So George A's work. George has been on the Possibility Project twice, so check out those articles. He's fantastic, really thinking about power structures. And then Cecilia just mentioned decolonizing wealth. And we'll have the transcript will also be as well. So my question is, and Nate, you just alluded to this, and my big word for 2022 is around accountability. And you just were talking about the Facebook whistleblower, right? How do we raise the flags? How do we call out some of these deans and division directors and those folks that are, you know, part of the input and output design and creation reinforcement? Like, is there anything within academic university structures where universities can be held accountable for really stepping into the new age of education and training? What would you all say to that?
I can take a first step. I think one, I don't know if this is like fully possible, to be honest, but so much of what happened is within universities, the P&L, if you will, to use a business term, is really within a school. And so I think the way to disrupt that is to think about, you know, where are some of these centers housed outside of ownership of a single school. And so we've experimented with that at Georgetown. The Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation sits at the provost office. It takes a wider view of impact. So it's not just from a business lens, it's not just justice, it's not just, a certain perspective. It makes it actually challenging as well. But I think that the school dynamics and the politics that revolve around that are important. And I think we also have to push back on the people that are kind of paying for it and change the demand and supply side of the equation. So going back to funders, well, it's great that you were part of XYZ school. We're thinking about education differently. You don't have to put all of your money into this school. Like, fund multiple schools or pool your money in a different way. I don't think those conversations are happening. And I also don't think they're happening with employers or parents to educate them on how education is evolving and different. And so we're kind of perpetuating this very linear thinking. And I think in higher ed, we're squeezed on both sides to try to make a difference, but both sides of that equation, the demand and supply, also need to.
I'm having a like massive live reflective moment. I think that the thing that I did a short stint in fundraising at the University of Michigan, focused particularly on research funding from large foundations. And I think one of the things I do think some foundations and individual donors recognize the dysfunction of our silos and have tried to utilize their money to get us to talk better to each other. And I think in some ways it's like also it's probably a pretty open secret that we're not very, sometimes not very good at that. And to that point is the thing I struggle with when things are centered in a provost office, especially at a university as decentralized as the University of Michigan, is that it often gets lost. And that in my own personal experience is that if you can get several deans to co-buy into something, you're then leveraging their networks in ways that can bring students together across the disciplinary boundaries. So the ways in which I've seen this work really well is actually a program that I started in the School of Public Health, but its actual mission was to bring students from across the institution into the topic of public health. And that was a buy-in across schools and colleges. And the other thing, maybe this is a little bit of a tangent, the thing I struggle with, which is this, like the elevation of technical discipline as like the thing that we're going to teach, and this is across, I think this is across disciplines, is the things that we actually think are really valuable, like I think is really valuable, often gets relegated to co-curricular activities. So then it's on the student to find the space in their time to get this additional part of their education, which I think is really interesting about your class, Nate, is that it's within the curriculum. And we have, like, actually I teach in this problem solving initiative in the law school, which has 11 of the 19 schools and colleges represented in a cohort of 40 students. Which is pretty awesome, but it's like so small sometimes that the size of it sometimes frustrates me more than gives me hope, but they exist.
Kristen, you have a question. Do you want to unmute and ask your question?
Sure. It's actually not a question, just a comment on what we're doing. So, I work for a social innovation center at Babson College, which is a business school, number one ranked for entrepreneurship, and of course, you know, rankings are an issue in and of themselves, right? I'm sure we all know. But one of the things that our center is really excited about right now, oddly enough, is the accreditation process, because so many of the accreditation entities are now focusing on social impact, sustainability, just like you see in the business world, focusing on ESG, just like you see in all these other places. So that's shifting. So right now, our team is ridiculously excited because we're working on the Prime Report, and we see this as an opportunity to, one, engage our students, engage our faculty, engage our staff, and actually show the college, hey, this is where we are, this is where we should be or could be going, and let's actually commit to this stuff. And we're seeing it as this really exciting opportunity. Like I said, it's weird that this report is now exciting, but we're like, hey, we can use this as a lever for change. So, that's just one of those types of shifts that by engaging all the stakeholders in this thing that will help us with rankings and help us with all that status stuff that leadership usually cares about. It's just that exciting opportunity.
Yeah. Any other questions? Put those in the chat. Cause you know, what I've seen a lot of are pitch competition, you know, other like small short programs, you know, and like you said, Anne, like it's an additional experience that students can sign up for, or it's, yeah, this pitch competition or a design challenge or something like that. And those just have always felt so short term to me. And, you know, students are at the end holding this giant cardboard check, but what they've created is actually not feasible, or, you know, it's not actually going to ever make it out into the world. So I'd be curious what your thoughts are on some of those short-term experiential opportunities that are offered, and what your thoughts are on that. Adesma, you want to hop in?
Well, I actually wanted to comment a little bit on the previous conversation, and I liked when Kristen, you know, brought up the point of accreditation, because that was the thing that was really mulling around for me. As Nate sort of spoke about, you know, some of these more radical ways in which we can begin to change the system in the way that we do education and sort of decentralizing. But accreditation is a challenge with some of that, right? I mean, and in some ways, I mean, yes, I have seen great progress and progressive thinking amongst various accreditation boards. But even with some of that progressive thinking about, oh, we need to have, you know, to Kristen's point, we need to have more of this social consciousness and connectivity and contextualization. But the ways in which they are looking to operationalize or not are still very much traditional. And so to you to say, I have this structure, but it exists outside of my unit or college or school, will cause an eyebrow raising from an accreditation, you know, whatever they are, person, evaluator, right? About, and you know, they're going to say, oh, well, but should it not be located? You know, I mean, so they still bring us back to that traditional way in which we operationalize these progressive ideas. And so in a way, some of that accreditation, whereas it is good and it's necessary and it ensures standards, But it is kind of holding us back from attempting some of these radical thoughts about the ways we can do things to be more equitable, right? To really disrupt some of these power dynamics. But then you have these structures that kind of again put the, put these chains or boxes around the way in which we are able to do it. And the challenge kind of is like, so you may have some smaller institutions that may not have same ranking of opportunities. And they are going to be, I mean, granted, you may have those folks who want to explore these things, but for them, the costs are so much higher, right? If we go against and we lose this accreditation or our accreditation is flagged, we're not going to get the students coming. I mean, there's such a ripple effect for being the true change maker in education. It's hard to be the risk taker. And I mean, and the ones who are most equipped to do the risk takers, right? All your Ivy League institutions. It's unfortunate we kind of need them to kind of set that trend, because once they do it, then everybody's, oh, then it's possible. We can all kind of follow through. But there is so much possibilities and innovation coming from our schools that aren't number one in whatever, you name it. And unfortunately for them, the risks are so high when they step out of line, because, you know, they have so much more to lose. And when they lose, the losses are great. So I'm grappling. I mean, going back to Anne, it's like you're having this reflective moment in the process. But, you know, it's tough. And that's why it's tough, because, you know, the system is so entrenched in these power dynamics and this dominant culture. And then once you step out of it, there is so much repercussions of what can be lost. And I guess I don't want to trivialize the fact that, yes, I want to be like Nate and say, I want the radical changes. I hate incremental. I want it radical. I want us to jump in and try the new thing. But I also know the costs for that are huge, and it is particularly huge for your more, when I say vulnerable institutions, in the sense of institutions that serve more minority students, institutions that you know, for those institutions, it's harder for them to take those losses, because it impacts them so much more deeply than it would our more prominent Ivy League types of schools.
Such a good point.
I totally agree with that, and I think the burden and risk do fall to institutions that have more, have more influence per se, but, you know, where it's not really a risk, to your point. And I think, you know, institutions like Georgetown, it's been really interesting to be part of it, but also to watch from afar, that are trying imperfectly to do some of that. There's an initiative called the Red House. It's literally a separately designed, innovation hub that's trying to disrupt higher education. And weirdly, like, it's meta, if you will, in the sense that they invite students to actually grapple with some of these things, which means they have to understand the entire system and all the incentives. And so I'm hopeful that there will be more of that. But you're right, it has to start somewhere. Two, I think what's interesting about learning, and maybe to the accreditation point, is that people don't always see the immediate value of these interdisciplinary approaches until way later. I think about some of my management consulting experience. Only when I was in more senior positions did we have training. Like, it was very much value your technical training. But then the softer side made a lot more sense in senior. And so we actually went back to school, if you will, to learn more of the social science and, like, how to think through things. And so I do wonder, as we think about accreditation, we oftentimes only value the first 4 years that someone is out of, you know, college. And I wonder if there's more data around how can you attribute it to those out years. And that, I think, is really where the value starts to come back to students, and like how it shapes their thinking. And that's hard. It's also hard as a professor, right? To know that, like, actually the stuff that I may teach probably will not, you might not see it as valuable as a student until 10 years from now. And you probably will not come back to me to tell me it's valuable. So I have to trust that there's some value being put out into the world. But I do wonder if that data could actually translate back. And there's real risk of not doing that in terms of you're seeing it, you know, in all the ways like Kristen and Desmond, you're talking about, like in terms of companies and ESG and all of that. But I think in a lot of ways, academia was ahead of the trend to know that those things were important like 10 years ago. It's only now happening in corporate spaces. So how can you attribute that type of thinking to an education program and how, you know, a discipline was taught? Those are just random ideas.
And if you don't have anything burning, unless you want to jump in, we're going to move to breakout rooms. Do you want to share any thoughts before we go to breakout rooms?
No, I was going to change to the topic of your question. So let's go to breakout rooms.
And I love that you all have said, like, I'm having a live aha moment. I'm integrating and synthesizing as we speak. I love that. It's fantastic. So now we want everyone to have a chance to really synthesize through conversation and chat for a bit. We always have a breakout room time for every single episode, so please stay on if you can. It's just a time for you to process. So just some quick community care items. You know, just be really mindful and share the time with others. You will have 12 minutes, and then we're going to come back and talk about upcoming wrap-up, but also upcoming events. So it's really a safe space in the definition that I can create, but that's kind of a hard definition right now. In terms of confidentiality, anything that is shared in your breakout room is confidential. It's just something that you're sharing in your small group. So just keep that in mind. And then one of you will be the facilitator. So whoever has the highest temperature in their town right now, you can really lead the chat to make sure that everyone is getting a chance to speak. So just introduce yourself and talk about what temp you think it is today. And I will send you little reminders in the broadcast messaging, letting you know when we're about halfway and we have about a minute left so you have a chance to wrap up. And then I really want you to think about what's resonating with you. You can share that de-identified in the chat of what really stands out that you've heard today. And that's just really the prompt. What's sticking with you? What questions are you still processing? What's really stood out as areas of learning you want to dive more deeply? So I'm going to set up the room. Some of you will have three, some of you have four. Just let me scoot you around a tiny bit for just a second. And then we will open those up. And again, you'll have about 12 minutes to have conversation. If you do get lost along the way, please come back to the main room and I will get you in the right place. So here we go.